Professor Buzz Scherr joins me to talk about the impact of poverty on people who are going through the justice system. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, what initiated you to consider this topic?
Last, really, 3 years now, I've been working in the legislature with the ACLU of New Hampshire as a cooperating attorney with them on issues relating to how poor people fare in the criminal justice system and constitutional and other abuses that they suffer simply because they're poor, not because of the crime they committed, but simply because they're poor. So let me give you an example. Yeah. Two and a half to three years ago, myself and the ACLU wrote a report on debtors' prisons in New Hampshire. And what we found is that a person who had been fined, let's say, $500 and hadn't been able to pay it back was called into court after a period of time. And the judge would say to them, "Can you pay the $500 today?" "No." "Okay, you're going to jail, and you're going to serve off that $500 at $50 a day."
Wow.
Appreciate that. Nobody actually would get $50 out of that. The court system wouldn't get $50.
Yeah, it cost the court system to have them in jail.
It cost the county jail system. Appreciate that. In New Hampshire, the court system is a state system. The jail system is a county system. So the court system didn't see the cost of them going to jail for 10 mm-hmm. days. The county did, at the rate of about $100 to $110 a day on average in New Hampshire.
Did the counties initiate anything to combat this? Did they work with the ACLU or anything?
Let me play that out.
Yeah.
So myself and Gilles Bissonnette, the legal director at the ACLU, we spent about a year and a half gathering data. And we found out from all the houses of correction but one in New Hampshire how many people in a year were being held in lieu of them paying their fines. Coincidentally, and very helpfully, there was a statute that was passed decades before that said if a court puts somebody in jail to serve off their fine in lieu of paying the fine, the jail had to document it and keep those statistics. So we could call them
up.
Or file a right-to-know request and say, "So, how many last year?" And they would, and we found that there were about 378 or 380 people over the course of either 2015 or 2016, I forgot which it was, who had been jailed in lieu of paying the fine. So we then went and we looked at, we had the ability, because we had their case number and their name, we had the ability to call up the court system and order what's called a case summary sheet that would tell us what happened in the case. And from that, we randomly selected about 40 cases to order up the transcript for the hearing at which they were, as a result of which they were sent to jail.
Wow. So there's lots of data you can get a hold
lots
of.
Lots of data. Uncharacteristically, oddly,
yes,
enough, oddly enough for the criminal justice system in New Hampshire.
We've talked about all sorts of cases from sports law to health law to criminal law, and usually it's like, oh, we kind of know this is happening. So we get a lot of information.
We did. And as a general matter, the criminal justice system in New Hampshire does not keep the court system.
Yeah.
Nobody keeps good data, but this was just
kind of an
anomaly. We got lucky. So it turns out that a shocking number of judges, probably 15 or 16 out of the 32 circuit court judges in New Hampshire, were on a regular basis putting people in jail without finding out whether they could afford to pay the fine, whether they had the financial wherewithal to pay the fine or not, ever. And they were doing so without appointing them a lawyer to defend them before they sent them to jail. And both of which are we argued, I think correctly, were unconstitutional.
Right.
So we spent a year and a half putting a report together, and we published a report, and which was, I think, fair to say, somewhat embarrassing for the court system. And the court system quickly got in touch with us, and through that, we were able to get changes in the rules of the court system and a statute through the legislature that requires there to be an ability to pay hearing before you send someone to jail without for not paying a fine. And at that ability to pay hearing, you're entitled to a lawyer. And number three, if you are sent to jail because you willfully failed to pay a fine that you have the ability to pay, you get to serve it off at $150 a day rather than $50 a day. We got that change for because of inflation. So that was my first pass at, and the ACLU's first pass. I brought this issue to the ACLU. That was our first pass at appreciating how poorly the poor are treated in the criminal justice system, and that the first time I got the inkling that money is used as to poor people to overpunish them. The same amount of a $500 fine for a middle class or upper class person has a far different effect on their lives than a $500 fine for someone who's surviving on Social Security disability income, who's surviving on no income, or as I was wont to say on several occasions in the legislature, who doesn't have the luxury of living paycheck to paycheck.
I mean, how many of these people are homeless? I'd imagine
a number of them.
I mean, a lot of. Yeah. I mean, they'd be rampant with drug issues and drug charges, I'm assuming.
All sorts of complications. So that was step one that got me thinking about it, and I think got the ACLU of New Hampshire thinking about it. And then we decided, okay, what's the next step on this? It's bail reform. That's the front end of the system, criminal justice system. Payment of fines is the back end, and there was an abuse going on there that I think we fixed well. The jailers have told us that the numbers of people being incarcerated for failure to pay a fine have dropped dramatically. By the way, all the county superintendents of the houses of correction were totally on board. We're unanimously in support of our debtor's prison report and the reforms that we put forward. Wow. Last session, the 2017-18 legislative session, we decided to take on bail reform. Much, much, much harder data to collect. Basically, what was happening, we found in the Superior and Circuit Courts in New Hampshire, is judges were doing two things. They were either using the setting of bail to hold people in jail because they thought they weren't going to show up, or they were thought that they didn't like the crime that they were alleged to have committed, and they thought they were dangerous. Mm-hmm. We looked at the biggest house of correction in New Hampshire, the Hillsborough County House of Correction. And as of September of 2017, there were 96 people in the Hillsborough County House of Correction that were being held on bail of $1,000, cash bail of $1,000 or less. That is, for want of having $100 and some collateral to post with a bail bondsman, if they had their bail at $1,000, they weren't getting out. Or in some cases, they would have bail at $100 or $200, and they didn't have the money to post. And our belief, I think correctly, based on our conversations with defense lawyers and prosecutors and others, is if your bail is set at $1,000 or less, it's not being set at that amount because the judge thinks you're dangerous. They just want to set a bail so that you'll show up. You'll have a financial incentive to show up. The problem with that second piece, you know, a concern for failure to appear, is constitutionally bail is there Cash bail is set to make sure you show up. It's not set to hold you so you will show up.
Right.
It's to have you meet the cash bail amount and have a financial incentive to show up. That's what it's for. And judges were not at all drilling down on the particular individual. I don't think most judges knew that somebody with $250 cash bail was going to sit in jail for 4 months until their trial came up.
It's just something they always did, and they never thought twice.
It's a simple assault. I'm setting bail at $250 cash. They didn't drill down on the particular financial details, whether that person could meet $250. So we set out to change the system so that you could not be held pre-trial on cash bail, simply because you didn't have the financial ability to meet the cash bail. That was change one. Change two, we dramatically expanded the array of crimes out there. In fact, all crimes, Class A misdemeanors and felonies, to be eligible for someone who was alleged to have committed one of those crimes, they could be held without any bail at all. They could be detained without bail if the prosecution could make a substantial showing that they, in fact, were a danger to themselves or others.
Yeah, because, I mean, if they're a danger anyways, why is the fact they have money in their account going to prevent anything?
Let's be more open and truthful about it. We think there's clear and convincing evidence, which is the standard, that you're a danger to yourself or others. And if the prosecutor meets that burden by calling witnesses, then they'll be held without bail. And that's a more honest, the new bail system. You can't be held just because you don't have money. But you can be held if it's been shown you're a danger. It's a more honest and transparent use of bail. It's been very controversial because until that point, prosecutors and police officers could stand up and say, "We think this guy's dangerous, set high bail." They didn't have to prove anything. They didn't have to call witnesses. They didn't have to present any evidence whatsoever. They could just say it and judges would do it. And now they're all cranky about the fact that, you know, they actually have to show that, you know, before you're going to hold someone for 4 months, 4 to 6 months because they're dangerous, you actually got to produce evidence of that fact. You just can't say it. Put that piece aside. Come back to the financial piece. There's an article in the Manchester Union Leader yesterday or the day before that said the Hillsborough County House of Correction is empty, if not literally. The superintendent of the Hillsborough County House of Correction says the bail reform statute has worked. People are not being held just because they don't have money. And there are numbers. They've closed two wings of the House of Correction there. They've asked for a budget reduction. Imagine that. An administrative agency of the government, in this case Hillsborough County, has put in a lower budget line for the jail because they've closed down two wings of the jail.
No, that's amazing. I'd imagine from the onset you might have had, it wasn't bipartisan support necessarily for something like this.
Oh, funny you should mention that.
And I mean, this closing kind of goes the conservative side, I'd imagine, going, oh,
that simple.
No.
We were very aggressive about providing information and talking to people on both sides of the aisle. When bail reform was passed in the state Senate, it was on a voice vote. That is, there was essentially no objection, and it passed on a voice vote in the state House of Representatives.
Wow.
It was a really, what we found, both with debtors' prison and why we picked bail reform second, was that on a bipartisan basis, the legislature really got the economic injustice of using money in the criminal justice system in the way it had been used in terms of punishing people, in terms of not paying fines for not having money, in terms of setting bail up front. So both are of a theme. It's an economic injustice. That right. is, you know, poor people don't have money. So why are we depending so much on exacting justice out of poor people using money. And that's really the theme I'm now more explicitly focusing on now. Right now, we have a bill pending in the House of Representatives that passed the Senate. It's a really nerdy insider bill. It involves the Office of Cost Containment. It's the agency, it's what I like to call the oxymoronic agency. It is an agency whose only task is to collect money from poor people who have been appointed a lawyer because they're poor. Therein lies my name for it. And we proposed some really mild changes this time around. That is, all right, assuming that that is ever an appropriate thing to do, really is not fair to collect money from people who have been acquitted of all charges or had all charges dismissed.
Yeah.
Force them to pay for the lawyer for the charges that they didn't choose to have brought down on them and therefore need a lawyer. So that's one provision. The other provision is to the Office of Cost Containment, known fondly as the OCC. A court would appoint a lawyer at the beginning of the case and then send the paperwork to the OCC, and they'd start processing the person through the collection system right then, even before, as their case was making it through the system. And the judges were not making any independent, they were making the judgment, you're entitled to appoint a lawyer, and then they were just checking the box, send this to OCC, where they're supposed to make an individualized judgment. Do you have the money to pay the state back for the cost of your lawyers at these set figures? That the judges were supposed to be making that individualized determination. They weren't. They were just checking the box on the appointment of counsel form. So we've now moved the decision as to whether the individual should have to pay the state back for the counsel they've been afforded to a sentencing hearing. To their at the end of the their case, where the judge is considering, am I going to fine this person? Or am I going to make them pay restitution? And in that package of considering what money they're going to have to pay back for fines, for restitution, or for their, we're going to include the money they may have to pay back for their lawyer. So the judge is holistically deciding, okay, how much money can I get out of this person as a part of either repaying the state, repaying restitution, or paying a fine? And it's a better place for higher quality judgments. And it will, and they're required by the changes in the statute we're looking for to do it on an individual basis and to look at the person's financial background to make sure that they're not saying, oh, they can pay based on the fact that they're receiving exempt income like Social Security disability. Again, same theme. If you are poor and you're living on Social Security disability income and just that, or on food stamps and just that, if you have a $500 debt or a $1,000 debt with restitution, a fine, and cost of counsel all added up, if not more, yeah, which is more likely, that debt is going to go on for 5, 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
And we are punishing, so a $500 fine with restitution of $500 is going to impact a poor person much more severely than a middle class or upper middle class person. And that's what I'm now thinking about more in the broader sense of, you know, we need to think about stopping or pulling back on using money as the primary way we punish poor people for crimes they're convicted of, because it has an outsized effect or a punishment we don't necessarily really intend. We don't want to saddle them with a debt for 10 years because they can't pay back a $500 fine on a Class A misdemeanor.
It's a waste of administrative resources, too, I'd imagine.
It's a tremendous amount. Yeah. The Office of Cost Containment has over $1 million budget.
$1 million to get money.
They end up $1 million to get to net $1 million.
Yeah. Yeah, you're hoping to put together a piece of scholarship revolving around this?
Yeah, in the long term. We're going to get through this academic session, both this academic year, to get to this summer and get through this legislative session to play out this last piece, the OCC piece. But it's a pretty shocking thought for most practicing judges that, wait a minute, I'm going to have to think of another way to punish poor people rather than saddling with them with 5 or 10 years worth of debt. It would be the just thing to consider, but it's a dramatic culture change for a huge majority of judges in misdemeanor courts.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.